when you had to wait a little while for the conversation to go forward. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund for Positively Revolting Radio, and now we go on.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Shout Out for the Climate, Our Future is a Constitutional Right, on Monday, October 29th at 11:30 a.m. at Terry Shrunk Plaza in Portland. Shout Out for Climate supports the young plaintiffs in the historic Juliana versus United States court case. The event will feature music, art, relationship, and momentum building for local youth interconnection and action. Again, that's Shout Out for the Climate, Our Future is a Constitutional Right, on Monday, October 29th, 11:30 a.m. at Terry Shrunk Plaza, 431 Southwest Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Here to Stay, an artist book fair the weekend of November 2nd through 4th at Matter in Portland. Here to Stay is a celebration of publication as art. The opening will be Friday from 5 to 9, and weekend events include tea tasting, book fair, art exhibition, and more. Participants include Just Seeds Artist Cooperative, Signal Fire, Eberhardt Press, Works Progress Agency, and many other artists, writers, and activists. Again, that's Here to Stay, an artist book fair the weekend of November 2nd through 4th at Matter, 811 East Burnside Street, number 124 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now it's time for One Land, Many Voices, exploring political, social, and cultural issues affecting Palestine and Israel.
Here with us is Jacqueline Keeler. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Thanks, Sayla.
So to start us off, can you just introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your background, what tribe you're a part of, and, you know, activism in Portland and what that looks like?
Yeah, I am a native journalist, and I'm based here in Portland, Oregon. I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and my father, however, is a citizen of a different tribe, the Yankton Sioux Tribe in South Dakota.
Right. So do you kind of fight this, the Native American struggle, through journalism, and is that your main platform?
Yeah. I write about current issues and try to provide a better understanding of the actual dimensions of how these issues impact Native people. I think a lot of Americans just are running on a deficit of information.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm one of those people. I hardly know anything, in part because the school system in Portland lacks any significant lesson plan on Native American history, but also because news outlets and corporate media simply don't report on the daily goings-on in Native American communities. So, jumping right in, throughout history, the U.S. government has used different tactics to silence and erase Native American history, like the relocation of Native American children into white homes, the Indian Relocation Act, and the current issue we're facing of overturning the voter ID law in North Dakota, which will essentially prevent Native Americans living on reservations from voting. Could you elaborate on other acts that have been passed and other efforts by the government to erase Native Americans and their effects?
Yeah, in my latest article that came out yesterday with NBC News, where I look at Elizabeth Warren and her claims to DNA, Native American ancestry, I really focus on how casting our Native identity as either minuscule strands of DNA as a race is really detrimental to Native people. And we are sovereign nations within the United States. We pre-exist the United States, and we politically persist. I mean, the treaties that were signed with Native nations, the U.S. Senate only ratifies treaties with other sovereign nations. They don't ratify treaties with ethnic groups or or, you know, minorities, they only ratify treaties with nations. And under international law, you know, treaties cannot be used to extinguish sovereignty. So a lot of Americans assume that once we sign treaties that we disappeared politically. That's not the case. We still exist. Our sovereignty is suppressed by the most powerful country on Earth. So now we face this whole issue with ICWA, with the Indian Child Welfare Act. It was an act instituted, I think, in 1978 in order to protect Native children from being mass removed from Native homes. I think some of the stats are 25% to 30% of all Native youth in the 70s were being removed from their homes. And this really falls under the Geneva Conventions on Genocide, where sort of ethnic cleansing occurs, and part of that is removing children from that group and then transporting them to the majority group, and in that way extinguishing them culturally and as a people. But the Indian Child Welfare Act is a federal law that's supposed to put stop guards so that Native families are not split up, and that tribes, as nations, have some say over their future, which are their youngest citizens, right? Their youngest citizens are not mass deported and removed. So I think every nation has a right to its children. I mean, imagine if 30% of all children from France were taken away. I mean, France would have something to say about it. It's the same thing with Native nations. But the way Republican and right-wing think tanks are casting this and are winning in the courts, they just won a case, which I detail in my article about a week and a half ago in a federal court in Texas, that basically got ICWA declared unconstitutional for being race-based, violating the Constitution, the 14th and 5th Amendments for equal protection under the law. And the issue that when I interviewed a lot of legal scholars was that this could have really a detrimental effect, really call into question the very term Indian, which is used in treaties and all kinds of laws. And if that term was outlawed, then, you know, it would really strike a huge blow to Native nations and possibly lead to another termination era. Termination was an act that was passed in the 1950s. And basically the goal was to terminate tribes, and then to another act, the Relocation Act, was passed to relocate the populations to urban centers. And so there's always been this ongoing desire to basically disappear politically Native nations. The issue of racializing our identity, which is a political identity, a legal identity based on citizenship, is a way of removing us from the international scene entirely. And so when Senator Warren comes forward with this DNA evidence to prove that she's actually Indian, right, or has Indian ancestry, as she's corrected it to say.
Like 0.02%, which is just
yes.
Minuscule.
Yeah. I mean, at the high range of 164th, you know, I'm 13/16th Native American and 3/16th European, right? And so, you know, at 3/16th European, I am 12 times as much European as she is claiming to be Native American. You know, and I cannot pass for white in this country. I'm obviously a Native person. So, and at the lowest rate of 1024th, the lowest range that's estimated from the DNA test that she did, you know, she has less Native ancestry than is average for white people in this country.
It just feels like such a trivialization of this struggle. You know, she's identifying as Native American and I guess expecting to receive sympathy for that, or, you know, I don't know what, I know she's trying to combat what Trump is saying and call, you know, she's calling her Pocahontas, but it just feels so empty.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, white people claiming Native ancestry is such a common thing. I mean, the minute you say you're Native American, you have a white person saying, I have a Cherokee princess grandmother. I mean, that's just such, I mean, there's even a name for it, the Cherokee Princess Syndrome. You know, every white family has that story. And the reason they have it isn't necessarily based on true history. It's based on the taking of the land. The idea being, well, you know, Native Americans aren't around to challenge us, so we're just going to make up a story that gives us greater rights to the land. So it's part of the story of colonization. And so her invoking it is not an act of solidarity with Native people. It's actually an ultimate act of a colonist. It's done in the absence of actual Native people. It's the result of genocide. And that's what makes it pretty abhorrent. And she has been, you know, Native people and Cherokee and Delaware people, which are the tribes that she originally claimed to be associated with, have been trying to speak to her on this issue for several years. This is not a new issue to us. To most of the world and to America, this has just happened overnight. But no, you know, this really came to light probably 7 or 8 years ago. And in that time frame, Native Americans have been repeatedly trying to speak to her on this issue. They've given her very good political advice, like don't do the DNA test. You know, the way to own Trump is to defuse his name calling by actually apologizing to the Cherokee Nation, forming real strong relations. I mean, the Cherokee Nation would have been so grateful to her if she had just apologized and actually worked with them on issues that are meaningful to them. She never co-sponsored any legislation until this year.
Yeah, I mean, forming a relationship is far more meaningful and far more long-lasting than claiming that she's a part of a group whose culture has been insignificant to her up to this point.
I know. I mean, I'm a 16th English. I don't claim to be English or British, you know, or even market myself as an English writer, even though I write in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, it doesn't even make any sense. And you know, it does racialize our situation. You know, it recalls the really horrible one-drop rule legacy in America. You know, we are not a race. We are citizens of nations. We want a U.S. senator. I mean, there are only 100 U.S. senators in the world. She's an incredibly powerful person, an incredibly powerful white colonial leader.
Mm-hmm.
She, you know, it's her job to make sure the treaties are honored. What has she done about that? The treaties we signed with the U.S. government were ratified by the Senate, the body of which she is a member. And she needs to treat with tribes as in a nation-to-nation way. And doing this undermines that. And it definitely renders meaningless, really meaningless, our political reality. And most Americans are not going to read her little, you know, subscript to her DNA test. They're just going to see DNA test, and they're going to assume that that's how you are Indian. And we, you know, we really did try to tell her, and she, you know, she didn't engage us. She ran away from a tribal delegation in Massachusetts, I'm hearing. You know, I wrote a piece in Yes Magazine in November, and I advised her on what to do when Trump calls her Pocahontas. And the name of the article is Pocahontas is not a name that should offend you. And the reason is that Pocahontas was a real Native woman who, you know, was kidnapped in the 1600s by the folks, the English colonists at Jamestown. She was held as a captive to try to extract more concessions from her father, who was the chief, the Powhatan chief in Virginia. And then she was transported to England, where she died. You know, she was raped as well. So her name is not a slur. Whatever Trump may try to do with it, it's not a slur. And taking that back is something she could do on the national stage. And I advised her whenever he gives that media circus to you, you know, sit there and remind people who she really was, and also recall the name of a missing and murdered Indigenous woman from today. You know, say their name. Use this moment to help me. So this is what someone who actually is Native would do.
It seems so meaningless, you know, like, okay, I'm 0.02% Cherokee, but it means nothing to her. And her focus is on Trump and not Native Americans.
It's really two white colonial leaders having a spat and using Native people as a political football.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, Native identity. And Native people are some of the most vulnerable people in the country. I mean, we have the worst statistical outcomes of any group, bar none. I mean, Native women have 3 times the rate of rape, 9 times the rate of murder in some counties. You know, Native men between the ages of 25 and 35 have 6 times the rate of death by police than Black men do. I mean, the war is still ongoing against Native bodies, you know, and the Indian Wars are not a victory. And so, you know, really using us this way is incredibly callous. And I can't say that, obviously, Native people, with Trump bringing on termination and everything of tribes, you know, he's not a choice for us. But we hope that the Democratic field candidates going into the 2020 primaries for president of the United States, some of them will speak to this in a much more coherent way.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, definitely looking at Kamala Harris or Cory Booker or these other candidates, hopefully they can begin to construct a much more helpful understanding of Native people as political entities.
Right. Okay, so is there a difference to you between European colonization and land grabbing here than there is with other groups throughout history? Or is this the same trend that we've seen with the Aztecs, with the Ottomans, with the Moors, with the Mongols? And in the future, will this just be seen as a European conquest, you know, just another military conquest? And is this, to you, the same thing that's happening in Palestine?
Yeah, for decades since I was growing up, Native people have always seen a lot of the same thing happening. And I think my entire life, that's been how Native people have viewed it, you know. And I think it's always about power. It's always about, you know, race is one construct utilized do these sorts of things, but it's not necessary. You know, I mean, look what the English did to the Irish or what the Swedes did to the Finns. It's a question of political power and military power. You know, I think definitely what you saw at Standing Rock was a military response by the state of North Dakota, that where the pipeline was, the Dakota Access Pipeline is all an unceded treaty land. That land was never ceded by treaty. Mm-hmm. In fact, by treaty with the United States, with the U.S. Senate, it's supposed to belong to the Great Sioux Nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's militarily held by the United States government in violation of international law. Treaties are international law. Just because you've been violating international law for 160 years doesn't make it right. And that's why the presence of a political presence of Native nations is so vital. Because without that, there's no one to hold them accountable. And so, you know, so for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which is part of the Great Sioux Nation, you know, has standing to invoke that treaty. So when they invoked it, that was a military response that we did not see with the Bundys. And Mount Rushmore is unceded treaty land. You know, there's that. I mean, it's supposed to be a symbol of American exceptionalism. All those, you know, all those presidents carved into the mountain there, and a sacred mountain, and yet no, it's actually held on land that the U.S. holds in violation of international law. And as recently as 1980, the Supreme Court ruled this was the case.
Yeah, I mean, this is just stuff I didn't know about. I didn't know how many treaties the U.S. has violated and continues to violate. It's just so frustrating to hear that, because what the U.S. is doing and has been doing is exactly what Israel is doing. They are in violation of countless international laws, both here and there, and nothing is being done. And it's because Israel and the U.S. have so much military might and political power.
Well, I mean, you know, when you look at Israel, it's funded to such a great degree by the U.S. You know, I mean, the U.S. government spends more money on Israel than they do on the Bureau of Indian Affairs here in the United States. If they spent that much for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I mean, Native people would be in a much different situation, you know. But, you know, I think the solution is always structural, because these are structural systemic problems, right? I mean, obviously problems and situations created and sustained by military strength, which is real and which is incredibly, you know, dangerous. But it's also it's structural. And I think that, you know, every time I hear other Americans say, I feel so bad for Indians, you know, calling us plaintive and all this stuff. And you know, we say things like, honor the treaties, but people don't know what that means, other than a good feeling or, you know, oh, I feel sad, I'll give $20 type of thing. But no, I think the thing that we have to do is we have to balance the equation structurally and politically. And I think that the main thing we need to do is actually, I've been talking to other Native people about this, of creating a federal indigenous government. And it would include all the different, I know this sounds like a pipe dream, but it would include all the different tribes. Because I don't think any of us can stand alone. Even I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, which is one of the largest tribes. I think the Cherokee Nation and the Navajo Nation are both quite large. The Navajo Nation has 350,000 members, which is about the population of Iceland. Mm-hmm. You know, it has a land base that's the size of Ireland.
I mean, that's significant.
Yeah, it's bigger, it's larger than 22 member states of the UN. You know, it's a nation within, and you know, and about 170,000 are still fluent speakers. But I don't think even the Navajo Nation could stand alone. I mean, any more than the state of Alabama could stand alone as a country. It would be a third world country, wouldn't it? You know, because this notion of states' rights and state sovereignty is kind of ludicrous, because none of them could really stand alone. Maybe, you know, some of them like New York State or California, but not Nevada, not where the Bundys are fighting for, you know, not Oregon even, you know. None of these states could stand alone.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, Native nations cannot stand alone. And I think that, you know, the Navajo Nation needs ports to do trade. You know, well, why not work with a Native nation that's on the coast, a federal indigenous nations that have their own federal government? So we don't have to turn to the U.S. We don't have to go to the Supreme Court to get rulings under federal Indian law, which is all based on the doctrine of discovery, which is completely racist. And was created early on in the 1827 by the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall. And there's these three court cases called the Marshall Trilogy, where he really kind of creates this whole sort of legal basis for the U.S.'s right to the land. And so, and he you have to realize that he is the Chief Justice of a brand new country. There's really no, he's making up the law, right, and trying to construct it in an argument for these things. And so he gets this case where there are two white men, right, who have purchased land, the same land. They have titles to the same land. One of them purchased it from the tribe, and the other one purchased it from the U.S. government, from the state. So he has to decide whose title is more valid. right? So, you know, he turns to papal Vatican law. Right? I mean, this is a Protestant country. He turns to Vatican law and he says, okay, so there are a couple of papal bulls, one of them in like 1492 or something, and one of them in 1550, I think. And they say that the Pope declared that when this whole notion of a discovering nation, so when a discovering European Christian nation comes to a place, discovers a place where the people are not Christian and not under the Pope, right, they have a right to land, but the fee simple title to land reverts to them automatically,
mm-hmm.
magically. And then the people who live there, the indigenous people, basically the only title they have to the land is that of occupancy and use, like the animals have. And this is still, to this day, this is active law in the United States. This is the basis of all the land rights in the United States, the title.
It's so ancient, like we...
I know. I mean, and you know, and really only colonial states use this. I think the United States and Canada and Australia. As recently as 2005, in the case of the Oneida Nation versus the City of Sherrill, New York, in that case, the City of Sherrill, New York, leased its land from the Oneida Nation in the 1890s. They signed a 100-year lease. They thought that the Oneida would not be around in 100 years, and so they signed this lease for $1 a year for 100 years. We can't rely on the court system in the United States, that the law is all built around upholding the rights of a colonial government. There's no way we can get justice in these courts. They're built to rule against us. We can't be a subsidiary of the United States. And this is where the inequality occurs. If Americans really, really think that this was a terrible thing that happened, this is what they could do. They could elect a government that would approve this.
So I guess speaking about land grabbing, as a Palestinian, I've been struggling with blaming all Israelis for the takeover of Palestinian land and being frustrated with all Israelis for the actions of the government. And, you know, I'm still frustrated by it. And in a lot of ways, I think it's valid. But the same idea and the same frustrations can be applied to Native Americans here. Like, I literally live on the streets Siskiyou and Klickitat, which to me is just a really, really sorry acknowledgement of this country's colonization. You know, it's saying, oh, yeah, the Klickitat and Siskiyou tribes, they used to live here. We're going to name two streets after them and call it good. Anyway, I guess I'm just wondering where you stand on this. Like, do you share the same resentment towards Americans living on stolen land as I do with Israelis?
I guess I believe in a two-state solution, which is, I guess, what I'm proposing with my federal indigenous government. I think that the main thing that I look at is, I think with the creation of a very strong political identity for Native people through a recognized entity, that the perception that Americans have of Native Americans will change. And as long as we are invisible politically, we will always be in the past. My main focus is on really hammering down the rights to lands that we already possess, that we still possess, and that we have by treaty. But I feel like removing large numbers of people, like from the city of Portland, would only be a human rights catastrophe. So I don't necessarily feel that way. You know, it does differ in how we manage it. I mean, and I think in Palestine and Israel, it's such a small area that I think it's much more, it's more like in South Dakota or North Dakota, where you're really more in each other's face all the time, and there's much more direct conflict. You know, right now, if you go back to where Standing Rock is, there's so much hard feelings there. And just, you know, it's very difficult. And the North Dakota ID law, part of it has to do with that, you know, and the power of Native nations to have an impact. You know, I think it's in states where it's very close, you know, the Native vote can really decide who's going to be the senator. But that's where it is.
So, you know, many times when discussing the future outcome of the Palestinian state in relation to Native Americans, people, and like I used to be guilty of this too, talk about Native Americans as if they're a group of the past and as if they're not something that can exist in modern times. You know, like the struggle was in the past. There aren't issues currently that they're facing. And in an article I read said that this type of attitude is, you know, of course, harmful and destructive for Native American identity and culture, but it's also allowing the colonizers to win by silencing the current struggle for Native American autonomy and the current issues that they face. What is your opinion on this? Is the discourse around Native American struggle generally discussed in the past tense? And is that one of the reasons for how difficult it is for Native Americans to find representation?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we are 1% of the population, which means that 1 in 100 people in this country are Native American. You know, not like kind of pretend Native American, but really Native American, you know? And but how often have 1 in 100 of the people you met been Native American?
No,
I mean,
yeah.
So it's I think I think it's we are really invisible. It's so often I will meet people and they will tell me I'm the first Native American they've ever met, or they didn't know that we were still around. They'll say things like this, and then immediately they'll say, by the way, I'm part Cherokee. You know, and they immediately want to kind of claim your identity. They want to creep in and claim it like that, you know. So it's and of course, you know, the representation in the media is all historical. It's not contemporary. You don't have protagonists in any movie or TV show, or even in books that most Americans read, that are Native, you know, contemporary, normal Native people, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. And so we're not, our lives are always in the past. I mean, imagine, you know, I've done a lot with the mascot issue, and I started a group called Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, and we trended the hashtag Not Your Mascot in 2014 during the Super Bowl. And I often, you know, I'll have people say, like, what about the Vikings, you know, as being similar to a Native mascot? And my point is always, well, imagine that this was the only way you saw white men. Imagine that you never saw a white man be president of the United States. You never saw a white man, you know, saving the world in a Hollywood movie. You never saw a white family featured on a, you know, TV show. You know, you never saw white people except as Vikings. What would be the first thing you'd say when you meet them? Where are your horns? Where's your longboat? Like, bringing up books, you know, I go into Powell's, and how many books are written from the perspective for the protagonist who is anything like me, a Native woman living in the early 20s? I mean, you know, probably 5 or 6, right? I mean, not a lot. Imagine that that was the world of the white man.
And for children to see that, and for children to see these mascots as, like, you know, whatever, the Redskins, and, like, how detrimental that is for a Native American child to grow up with that kind of rhetoric and that kind of attitude. It's so harmful.
Yeah, it's harmful all around. I mean, studies have shown that, of course, for Native youth, Dr. Stephanie Freiberg, she's Tulalip tribal member from Washington State, she did studies at Stanford and found that Native youth exposed to Native mascots suffered a decline in self-esteem, and that Native youth who claimed to be okay with mascots had an even more severe decline in self-esteem, because mm-hmm. it takes a lot of energy to make that kind of thing all right.
Right.
It's energy they could be putting in something else. Yeah, then they also, the University of Buffalo compiled a bunch of studies examining different studies that had already been done. What they found was that Native mascots promote primarily negative stereotypes. And that not only that, but once people start participating in Native masketry, they begin to have negative stereotypes about other races and ethnic groups as well. It kind of has an effect. So it is overall, for a country that is multi-ethnic, multiracial, it's a poison, and it's really unnecessary. I mean, it's not needed. They estimate that there are about 2,000 high schools in the United States that have Native mascots. And I sometimes make the point that, you know, you realize that we're 1% of the population. The black community is about 10% of the population, about 10 times our size. Well, imagine there were 20,000 high schools with black mascots. Imagine all the stereotypes and the insanity that would come out of that the black community would have to deal with, on top of everything else. And most Native people live off the reservation because we're economic refugees. So we tend to be a minority amongst minorities in urban and suburban areas. And often a Native child, the most common experience is to be the only Native kid in a high school. That's the most common experience. It's not common to be going to a school full of Native kids. That's actually a minority, like 20-25% of all Native kids go to school in a high school full of Native kids. Mm-hmm. That's just not normal. And so most Native kids are the only kid in the high school. Is it really supposed to be their job to counter all of those stereotypes and educate like 1,000 other kids?
No, of course not. It's the educator's job, you know?
Yeah. So what they're doing by teaching children this is they're continuing these stereotypes and negative stereotypes into the century, basically, because these kids are 5 years old, some of them. I mean, they're going to carry this until they're 70, 80, 90. And so it really is best that we just get rid of them. But I do think a lot of this sort of thing does arise out of the lack of political power. And I do think that once we are more politically identified and powerful, then a lot of this sort of appropriation of identity and sort of colonized, you know, acting in the absence of will stop.
Mm-hmm. So to wrap up, what would appropriate reparations for Native Americans look like? Like, you touched on the fact that can't remove people from Native American land, like that would create more refugees. But what are you looking for?
Well, like I said, I'm really, I think this whole, obviously, a more equitable relationship, you know, and a relationship that is not abusive, I think would be good. I mean, right now we have an abusive relationship that causes all this suffering. I mean, the American dream is built on the suffering of Native people and of Black America as well. And like I said, I think that it has to be a structural political solution, and recognizing Native nations as fully sovereign rather than suppressing sovereignty and making our identity fuzzy in order to disappear us. And you know, I mean, the reason why you and so many Americans don't know anything about it is the result of this policy. It's the policy of the United States to make sure you don't know. It's not an act. So I think changing that policy and really allowing full control over our land and you know, returning a lot of lands that we still have a right to under treaty. I mean, when you realize that encompasses everything in South Dakota, it would encompass everything west of the Missouri River, half the state, and all the Black Hills. I mean, you get an idea of the level of wealth that could be generated from all that. The reason why America has been so profitable is because they haven't paid a fair rate. And every immigrant that comes here partakes in that taking. You know, whether they are coming here as refugees or what have you, the American dream is built on that taking. Yeah, but I definitely think it has to be structural in nature, and creating a viable federal indigenous government with checks and balances internally is really the best way to go.
And by allowing that's sort of owning up to what has been done to Native Americans and what's currently being done to them, and, you know, taking some responsibility, because I don't think that our government or anyone really has provided a significant acknowledgement for what's happened. And I think that that is also really detrimental.
Of course it is. Yeah, I just think that once you create a very visible political identity for Native people that has rights and laws attached to it and is visible to all Americans, then a lot of this will go away. I mean, it's not as fun to take something from someone who is obviously there and to which you owe some sort of real political relationship.
Right, and of course, a significant voice and representation. Yeah. Wow, thank you so much for speaking with us. This has been really informative.
Yeah, definitely.
Again, that was Jacqueline Keeler speaking with us about the importance of Native American representation, awareness, and activism. On this segment, you heard the songs Kullun Ardun Daba Bet by Dam and Shadia Mansour and Nina Cried Power by Hozier. Again, I'm Leila Kanaan. Stay tuned for the next segment on One Land, Many Voices.
Ahlan wa sahlan and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. Today on the show, we interview Diana Bhutu. She is an analyst, former legal advisor to Mahmoud Abbas, chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization. We speak with Diana about the failed Oslo Accord that was signed 25 years ago this month. Diana, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you. Thank you, Saeed. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. It's great to have you again on the show. This year, 2018, marks the 70th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba catastrophe of 1948. It marks the 51st anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip, West Bank, and East Jerusalem. And this particular month marks the 25th anniversary of the Oslo Accord that was signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and Israel. If you could take us back to that date, please. You used to advise the Palestinians, the PLO. Tell us and our listeners, please, the main points of what Oslo was supposed to do for the Palestinians and why they signed on.
I was somebody who was in my teen years at the time, somebody who thought that the way that many people thought that Oslo was actually going to bring about peace. So I was mistaken in the belief, in large part because I believed the newspaper accounts. I believed what I had been told and what I was listening to. I believed that Oslo was actually going to lead to Palestinian liberation. I didn't believe the critics, such as Edward Said and others, who said that Oslo was actually going to lead to further subjugation. So in the minds of what I think the Palestinian leadership at the time who signed on to Oslo, what I think that they thought that they were getting out of it is something very different than what was actually on paper. So what I think that they thought that they were getting out of it was that within 5 years, and there's a reason that they believed five years, it's because it's spelled out in the 1994 agreement, they believed that in 5 years, Palestinians would be free. And they believed that within those 5 years, more and more Palestinian territory would be transferred from the Israeli army to the Palestinian Authority. They believed that settlement activity was going to stop. And they believed that that at the end of a five-year period, there was going to be freedom. Now, what ended up happening was exactly the opposite. And I'm not somebody who believes that this was just a question of poor implementation of Oslo. It was exactly what Oslo was meant to do,
which is to continue the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories, the expansion of the colonies, and so on and so on and so on. But all of that was not realized at that time by the PLO?
No, it wasn't. And there were reasons that it wasn't realized. First, because I think it's important to keep in mind that at the time, the PLO was under intense pressure. This is a PLO that had come out at the end of the Gulf War and had been supporting Saddam Hussein. International support for the PLO was at an all-time low. At the same time, I think that they were also afraid of losing, their name as being the Palestinian leadership. And because the Intifada was taking place here in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. And other things is I think also that there was a lot of deception. I can tell you in terms of some of the deceptive things that had been iterated to me when it came to settlements is that that there had been an agreement, a private agreement between Rabin and between Arafat, that there wouldn't be a construction of settlements. And the reason that Rabin said to Arafat that he couldn't include it in the text itself was because then he knew that his coalition would never push through or sign on to Oslo. And, it's these types of things of in part being deceived, in part wanting to be deceived, and in part wanting to be relevant, that is what the hallmark of Oslo was. I think the big problem, however, is that on a certain level, much of the leadership believed that even though they were signing on to this flawed agreement, that at least the international community was going to step in and do something. But what we've seen for the past 25 years is exactly the opposite, that the international community has completely stepped away and removed its hands. So while they definitely signed on to a bad agreement, some of them understanding it, many of them not, I do think that one central element that they all believed was that the international community was going to do something, and it turns out that they did absolutely nothing. Now, we can't blame the Palestinian leadership for the settler population doubling. We can blame those who make the settler population double, which is Israel. We can also blame those who allow it to double without any consequence, and that would be the international community. It's inconceivable that you know, Palestinians, who by and large, if you look at the opinion polls at the time, were also very supportive of Oslo. It's inconceivable that these people would have supported a process that was leading to more and more settlements, more and more checkpoints, and so on. But this is what we had, and there was the ability to stop this process, whether it's the Israeli government or the international community. But both of them chose not to do so. And in fact, like, the for me, the big, when you look back at Oslo, the big turning point in terms of where Israel was heading happened in February 1994, when Baruch Goldstein went into to the Haram al-Ibrahimi, the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron during Ramadan, as people were praying at the Fajr prayers, and gunned down Palestinians, with the aftermath being that there was closure imposed on Palestinians, checkpoints put up in front of the Haram, and rather than Rabin evacuating those settlers, and he certainly had the opportunity to do so, and he had the support to do so, he instead doubled down and made sure that there were more settlers that were brought in and that Palestinians paid the price. Again, these are the things that that ended up being the real awakening points for people, including the Palestinian leadership. And the issue that I cannot stress enough is that it was that Israel was allowed to do whatever it wanted to do, because suddenly we were in this framework of negotiations, and the international community didn't want to impose sanctions.
Now, you've mentioned the Israeli settlements or colonies, and you've said that between 1993, when the Oslo Accord was signed, and 2000, the population of the Israeli settlers doubled in size, and up to this date, I believe that has tripled to almost 700,000 Israeli settlers living. And when we talk about settlements and colonies for our listeners, and I would like to hear more from you about them, we are talking about colonies inside whatever is left of Palestine, inside the occupied West Bank, inside occupied East Jerusalem, not inside Israel itself, where they are building more and more areas for themselves, correct?
Yes. So in terms of the numbers, you're correct, it's close to 700,000, which is more than triple. On the eve of the signing of Oslo in 1993, it was a little under 200,000. And now we're looking at close to 700,000. Some even project a little bit beyond 700,000. And yes, we're talking about only those settlements that are in the West Bank, and in which includes East Jerusalem, and in the Gaza Strip. And the reason that I'm only focused on those two areas is because that's the area that is specified in the Oslo agreements itself. It's not my own personal belief or designation.
And we hear it all the time. As a matter of fact, just yesterday or a couple of days, Israel seized another Palestinian land for what they call settlement expansion. Tell us more about that, because that is truly ongoing. They continue to demolish Palestinian homes. They continue to kick Palestinians out, seize their property for settlement expansion. And then they build more roads, and they take more land to secure the roads that only Israelis can use to reach, to go in and out of those Israeli colonies.
Yes, it's like cancer. I mean, if you liken it to a disease, which it is, it's like cancer. So it starts off with one small area, and then it suddenly expands because now they need to have houses for the other families, and then they need to have playgrounds, and then they need to develop schools, and then they need shopping. Who doesn't do shopping? And then they need roads to connect that settlement to another settlement, and then they need, in addition to that road, they then need a security perimeter road, and next thing you know, it's spread and spread and spread and spread throughout the West Bank. This is why it's not at all surprising that what Israel talks about in terms of the West Bank land is 60% of that land is land that's either with settlers on it or zoned for settlements. And so the amount of land that Israel keeps taking is expanding and expanding and expanding. Now, in the process, anything that comes in the way of these expansion plans are things that suddenly get demolished, which is what we're seeing now with the community in Khan al-Ahmar in around the Jerusalem area. What we also see in other areas in the south, Costa Sucia, where what the Israelis are intending to do is build and expand settlements, connect those settlements to one another, and then connect those settlements into larger Israeli cities.
You know, when we look at what is happening now in Khan al-Ahmar, as you mentioned, it's a Palestinian, it's a very small Palestinian village in the Jerusalem governorate, and Israel is kicking out Palestinians from their own land, as you mentioned, to build, to expand settlements and connect settlements together. I mean, we are witnessing what happened in 1948, 70 years ago. Today, it is ongoing, and it is truly ethnic cleansing of Palestine.
Yeah.
The list that Israel does on daily basis against the Palestinian, part of its ethnic cleansing of Palestine, is humongous, from extrajudicial executions, murder, killing, almost on daily basis. Not just in the Gaza Strip, but also in the West Bank. They pass so many laws that discriminate against Palestinians. Military checkpoints. That's something that we'd like to hear from you, because, you know, sometimes I talk to friends and people here, military checkpoint, they think like in the U.S., oh, the police, they have a roadblock kind of to make sure you're okay, and they check your license and you go. They don't realize that people, women, pregnant women, people going to schools, work, hospitals, they are being subjected to humiliation, and they stand at the military checkpoint for countless hours to move from one area to another.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's so difficult when discussing Palestine. Which issue do you focus on? Which only issues do you focus on? And as you very eloquently put it, there are so many issues. So on the issue of checkpoints, where do I begin? There's some 500 obstacles that are in place in the West Bank, just hindering transportation and travel even within the West Bank. So these are people who are being blocked even within their own space, going from one town to the other town, with Israeli obstacles, sometimes checkpoints, sometimes roadblocks set up in their way. But checkpoints themselves, it's one of those issues that is, unless you see it, it's very difficult to describe. I can tell you what it's been like for me living here. I've been living here for quite some time, having to maneuver checkpoints, which is, you think about them, they're part of your every single day calculation. You waste so much energy and time thinking about what's going to be the easiest way to get in and to get out. Because what you don't want is, you don't want to be stuck in sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 hour long checkpoints. And you certainly don't want to be subjected to the endless rounds of questioning and humiliation that you face at the checkpoints. And by the way, I want to make it clear, those who are allowed to pass the checkpoints are the very privileged few. There are thousands of Palestinians, fewer than 10% of Palestinians are even able to get near a checkpoint because they're barred from travel. So, you know, you're talking about people who are under the age of 25, who live a few kilometers away, a few miles away from the sea, who've never been able to see the sea, or Palestinians in Gaza who've never been able to leave the Gaza Strip to get a permit to come to the West Bank, to visit Jerusalem, to go see Nazareth. This is what our life has been confined to, is this constant thinking about, how do I move around? Which way do I go? Am I going to be facing a body search? Am I going to be able, if you're somebody who is not able-bodied, to go be able to fit through the turnstiles? Am I going to be crushed standing in line along the way because there are thousands of people who are trying to cross? And sadly, this is the reality for people living here on a day-to-day basis who go to work, go to school, or are trying to get medical treatment. They're constantly subjected to these checkpoints. As I said, I don't know which issue to highlight and which one not to highlight, because it's all so important, and it all affects the way that we live our lives daily, and the daily denial of freedom. And as I said, it's death by a thousand cuts.
And also, Diane, I want to ask you about the Israeli apartheid wall that it started to erect several years ago, cutting through Palestinian villages and towns, basically grabbing more land and destroying Palestinian homes and families as it cuts through them. Is that still ongoing? Does Israel, is it continuing to expand and build that apartheid wall?
Yes, absolutely. It's in parts, it's in particular in the south of Bethlehem, the wall is continuing to be built. But in other parts where it's not continuing to be built, they've in parts put it on hold. The same regime is still in place, which is that of having either a 25-foot high concrete wall or series of different barbed wire fences along the way, or a series of obstacles that you simply can't go around. So yes, this is continuing. What's important, and this is where I go back to the international community, there was a court decision that came out by the International Court of Justice in the year 2004. And the International Court of Justice said to Israel that it has to dismantle its wall, but it also said to third parties, to the international community, that they shouldn't be dealing with Israel and with this apartheid wall. In other words, that they shouldn't be doing anything that is going to be either facilitating it or recognizing it or supporting it in any way. And yet what we've seen is that since this decision came out, which was in 2004, we're now in 2018, and the international community has done absolutely nothing.
There are so many points we want to talk about, so we are fortunate to be speaking with you to tell us and our listeners the reality on the ground in occupied Palestine. Gaza Strip, Israel withdrew its forces, quote-unquote, several years ago. We know it continues to strangulate the Gaza Strip. Some describe it as the largest open-air prison in the world. People are dying there. They are being killed almost on a daily basis also inside the Gaza Strip by the Israeli occupation forces. We are witnessing wars after wars, war crimes committed on the Gaza Strip, one of the most densely populated areas on this planet. Nearly 2 million people live there. Tell us more about what's happening in the Gaza Strip.
The Gaza Strip is a place that's very near and dear to my heart because I lived there for some time. I lived there during the period that the Israelis were dismantling their settlements. They never pulled out. They were just dismantling the settlements, and the settlers were leaving, but the army, of course, stayed. And during that period, I remember very well what it was like to live under siege. I remember seeing the constant shortages of food, whether it was dairy products or bread or medicines. I remember people standing in line just trying to get bread. And this is, by Israel, it's a man-made disaster. This is exactly what they wanted it. Now, I lived there before all of the bombing campaigns happened. The bombing campaigns happened the first in 2008, 2009, the next in 2011, 2012, and then the most devastating one was in 2014, when Israel maintained its bombing campaign for over a month and killed more than 2,000 Palestinians. Since that time, the Gaza Strip has never really been rebuilt. So everything from them not having proper water supplies. In fact, most of the water, 90% of the water, is close to 95% of the water, is not drinkable. At the time that I lived there, I remember how undrinkable the water was, to the point where when a person bathed, I would remember seeing my hair fall out in clumps from the dirty water. Today, a child in Gaza who is 11 years old has never seen 24 hours of electricity. They've lived their entire life without functioning electricity. And this is because Israel does not allow the power transformer that's in place there to be rebuilt, and certainly doesn't allow enough fuel supplies into Gaza to keep it running, to keep the main transformer running. And so we've seen that the quality of life in Gaza has not only deteriorated, but is bordering, in the words of the UN, on a man-made catastrophe. Now add to this that for 25 Fridays in a row, since the end of March, the Palestinians have been marching towards the electrified fence that separates Gaza, demanding their freedom. And in that period, more than 180 Palestinians have been deliberately gunned down. And I say deliberately because every Israeli soldier has a choice that it can make. They know that these people pose absolutely no threat to them because they are both behind an electrified fence and there's a buffer zone between them and the soldier. And yet Israeli soldiers have built dirt mounds to be able to deliberately shoot down into the Gaza Strip, kill Palestinians who are protesting. We've seen thousands of injuries, close to 4,000 injuries where people are needing amputations. The hospitals in Gaza are unable to cope with this. And it's not just hospitals in Gaza. In fact, the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, said that there isn't a hospital in the world that would be able to cope with this number of people who are being injured with these particular injuries that they are coming in with, which is injuries that end up leading to amputations. If this isn't a cry for our morality and for people to speak up and to recognize what's happening and to stand in support and be pushing for their freedom, I don't know what is. This is the cry of our time, when you see that for 25 Fridays in a row, people have been going out just demanding their freedom and getting gunned down. I really don't know what will move people any longer. I want to just raise one more issue side when it comes to the issue of health that I think people are not really fully aware of when it comes to Gaza, which is that in the Gaza Strip, there aren't any cancer treatment facilities, and there's certain types of radiation therapy, certain types of chemotherapy that Israel won't allow to be brought into Gaza. The reason that there aren't any radiation therapy places, by the way, is because Israel won't allow them for quote unquote security reasons. So people with cancer inevitably have to exit the Gaza Strip to be treated. What Israel has done is they've said that they are now going to hold people who have cancer, particularly women, hostage, and they're not letting these people exit to go get cancer treatment. What they've said is that if the patient or any member of the patient's extended family is in any way linked to Hamas, then they're not going to give them an exit permit. This is in effect using health as a political tool, and people who are in desperate need for medical treatment as a political tool and holding them hostage. And it's repugnant. This is again one of those issues that the world should be pushing back against Israel and demanding that people be given access to the medical treatment that they need and not be held hostage.
This is truly shocking. When somebody ill has cancer, needing desperate treatment to go to a hospital, Israel would look into the background of that person, and if he or she or their relative is linked to Hamas in some way, they would deny that person's medical treatment?
Absolutely. This is how depraved it's become.
It's like you mentioned it before, it's ongoing ethnic cleansing of Palestine at various level, at various forms. They just don't want Palestinians to live there.
I often ask my friends who are in South Africa what life was like in the early 80s, let's say 1982, 12 years before liberation. And they paint a very bleak picture of division, of a lot of violence, of not really seeing where things were going, of a very difficult and rough life. And none of them would have been able to predict that 12 years later that they would be seeing Nelson Mandela freed, and that there is a black president who's leading a non-apartheid South Africa. And I think that that's where we have to really focus our energy. And if we keep our eyes on the liberation of Palestine by holding Israel accountable, I do believe that we will see freedom.
Very well. We want to thank our guest very much, Diana Bhutu, an analyst, former legal advisor to Mahmoud Abbas.
And that pretty much does it for the show today. Thanks for listening.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Valley Views continues the conversation with president of AFSCME Local 2975 in Corvallis about the importance of a strong union movement.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. This month, our meeting of the KBOO Board of Directors will be on Monday, October 29th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Site of Riot at 807 Northeast Coote Street in Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Law for the People Convention from October 31st through November 4th at the Benson Hotel in Portland. This five-day conference of movement law and organizing has several events and speakers open to the public, such as the keynote address by Seattle Council member Kashama Savant. The conference-only events includes workshops, major panels, and events such as Smash the Patriarchy Lunch with Walida Emerisha, and much more. Again, that's the Law for the People Convention from October 31st through November 4th at the Benson Hotel, 309 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community.